overseas. Our good friend TJ O'Hara, former independent candidate for president in the United States, strategic consultant, author, speaker, joins us from just outside San Diego. G'day, TJ.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Good. And a belated happy 4th of July, Independence Day. Big day over there, yeah?
Well, thank you. It was indeed Independence Day, but given the sad state of our public education system, I'm afraid that based on our current behavior, we may need to rename the holiday the Declaration of Dependence Day. So
Tell us a bit more about that, because independence is a big deal, but you get the feeling increasingly, not just in your country, it's becoming a rare concept.
Well, independence is what differentiated the United States from any prior form of government. And the Constitution that followed codified the grand experiment based on that singular principle, that it was the people who were sovereign rather than a ruling aristocracy or a government. But we seem to have forgotten that. You know, we've had recent cases in the Supreme Court, affirmative action, and as well as one on student loan forgiveness that were decided by the court. And they serve as examples of what I mean, because if one were to read the majority concurring and dissenting opinions to form a cogent view of the rulings, they might conclude that the cases were decided appropriately. However, the Supreme Court's become a political target. And regardless of whether there's a substantive legal basis for its opinions, it's easier to call the justices crude names. They like to use the term extremist court, rather than argue the merits. And then the critics immediately turn to the king, or I mean the president, sorry, I misspoke there, unilaterally take action. And members of the House and the Senate, who've long since abandoned their responsibility to actually legislate, they jump on that bandwagon immediately. So it's created a real problem.
Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe take us through both of those cases one by one. Affirmative action, that was concerning Harvard University, a prestigious university, and a couple of others who have been giving applicants positions based on color, ethnicity, etc. And that was appealed, and the Supreme Court, I think 6-3, said there would be no more affirmative action.
Correct. And just to step back a little bit, the basis of affirmative action, there was a laudable intent to assist Black Americans who otherwise may not gain access to college. And this has been going on for about 40 years. So legislators crafted the concept of affirmative action, which in its most basic sense provided Black Americans with an admission preference. Now, back in 2003, I was involved behind the scenes in the first Supreme Court case that successfully challenged affirmative action. And to simplify the facts of that case so people kind of understand how it works, there was a university that had 150-point admission criteria with 100 points needed to gain admission. If you were Black, you were given 20 points for having been born Black, while a perfect SAT score was only worth 12 points. It didn't matter whether the student's parents were rich or poor. It didn't matter whether the students went to a private school or an underprivileged inner-city school. Only the color of their skin mattered. And therein lies the problem. The advantage was racially based, and that's what surfaced in this latest case. Well-educated Black children didn't need an advantage, and in fact, they were somewhat smeared by the implication they were given one. They didn't need it, but there was a presumption, oh, well, you got in because you got a preference. Meanwhile, poor inner-city white and Hispanic children received no advantage, even though they needed one. And the truth is, affirmative action allowed old white people, to be honest about it, to pat themselves on the back for helping Black children gain access to college. But it didn't address the real problem. Many inner-city students, regardless of color, received an inferior education for 13 years. And that's what we argued back in 2003. From kindergarten through 12th grade, they were given an inferior education. And the same white people who were patting themselves on the back for helping Black children, whether they needed it or not, did nothing to correct that school system, and they still haven't.
That's fascinating. I mean, that's really well explained as well. But from a distance, TJ, it just seems you've traveled so far from that wonderful I Have a Dream speech of Martin Luther King that you know, want to be judged by the content of your character, not by the color of your skin, where you look at America from a distance now and nearly everything seems to be divined just through this prism of race. Everything's about race.
They've used race. They've almost made the word ineffective. They've used it so much. Now the favored word of a particular party is extremist. Everything's an extremist, like the court is an extremist. They don't see, pardon the pun, shades of color the difference between their position and other positions. The Harvard case, which is the current one, the colleges like Harvard were getting too many applications for highly qualified Asian students.
Yeah.
And you know how it is. They can't have too many Asian students, can they, right? You know, so it's almost pathetic. So they began to cap the Asian admissions. And the most recent case demonstrated that that was racially biased, which is why the court ruled against it. And it was a good ruling. It was solid law. But because it threw out affirmative action, which had never been effective and had solved the wrong problem, it was immediately an extremist court, and they need to expand the court. What's funny is they want to expand the court but stack it with other people who favor their extreme positions.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. And you brought up student loan forgiveness. That's equally stupid. If an 18-year-old knowingly took out a student loan in the past, they had to repay it. But if they took it out recently, they believe the government should repay part of it.
But it's so absurd, because what about a tradie who spends $40,000 or $50,000 getting the ute and all the tools? Are they going to repay that as well? No, I don't think so.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
The situation is, if you take the loan out after the repayment by the government, you're stuck with repaying the whole loan. So it doesn't get rid of the problem. It just masks it. And the real joke is that student debt is tied to college expense, which is left untouched by this type of a Band-Aid approach.
Tell me this. We only have about 3 or 4 minutes. I want to get through a couple of things in that time. America, you know, in 2023, you've celebrated July the 4th. Where do you think your country's at? You know, you're 330 million now or thereabouts. You were 3 million at the time of independence, 30 million at the times of the Civil War. What do you make of your country? Are you positive about its future?
I'm positive about the future, but I'm also concerned, Greg. The challenge is the parties have spent billions of dollars and decades creating a conditioned response so that people will readily provide donations to political candidates and parties and that they'll cast their votes accordingly. If we can't overcome that behavioral conditioning, we're going to see continued fractionalization of the country. If people step back and whether they need to be frustrated or whatever drives them, we need to overcome that behavioral conditioning so they start looking at what's the actual problem. Are we actually solving it? And if not, let's get rid of the people that are there now. Let's bring in different people until we get the right mix of people who really want to solve the problem.
Well, at the moment, you've got a presidential election more than a year away, but the Republican race, you know, Donald Trump is dominating. He's way ahead of DeSantis, who doesn't seem to be making a big impact. The others are way behind. He looks the favorite to get their nomination, doesn't he?
At this point in time, it's way in advance. We don't even know. He could be in jail, for all I know, you know, by the time, which is tough.
But he can still run, can't he? He can run from in jail.
Yeah, who knows? You know.
And he would.
In a strange way. But look on the other side. We've got Joe Biden dramatically leading the Democratic candidates. Almost no one wants to challenge him. And when they do, they attack the person.
Yeah. But that's not tenable, is it? If his behavior and performance continues and his decline continues, TJ, as it is, that's not tenable. At some point, somebody will need to challenge. RF, you know, Kennedy Jr. is polling very well against him. He's not likely to win. But your governor out there, Gavin Newsom, he seems to be getting ready. And one or two other governors as well.
Right. You know, we talked about Gavin a little bit last week. I'll let you in on an interesting thing. If he somehow becomes the DNC's preferred candidate and President Biden steps aside and allows him to run as the candidate, you've got something interesting going on where Donald Trump Jr. and Nigel Farage are scheduled. They were actually scheduled to be in your area this week, and that's been pushed off. I know there was a group in Australia that was trying to prevent them from getting visas and so forth. They suggest that it's just been deferred, that it's not a big issue. But what's going to be interesting, a lot of people don't know that Donald Trump Jr. may be accompanied by his fiance, Kimberly Guilfoyle. Now, the reason that's interesting, Kimberly Guilfoyle was Gavin Newsom's first wife.
The plot thickens, yes.
But she was only his first wife until he cheated on her with his campaign manager's wife. So if you think that's not going to come out, you know, if and when he chooses to run, he's got as much baggage as the next person. He photographs well. You know, he glad hands people. He's never seen a camera he doesn't like. But his accomplishments, you know, I could put on a Post-it note and probably not use much of the space. I wouldn't run out of ink, let's put it that way.
TJ, I need to wrap it up, but just before you go, I know you keep an eye on things happening all around the world. Are you following our upcoming referendum about The Voice? And it kind of ties in a little bit with the affirmative action you were talking about earlier.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been following that with a lot of anticipation. I can't wait to see how that comes out. Quick opinion on my part, I think there's some structural issues that maybe I'm just not cognizant of how they've been resolved, but they seem to remain somewhat unclear to me. It's my understanding the reparation word has been floated, and that's a serious philosophical and monetary challenge. We're going through that in California right now. They're up to, like, the recommendation was $5 million per person if they happen to be a Black American and live in California, which never had slavery. The real question is whether the issue will be addressed by a relatively informed electorate or a relatively uninformed one, and I think how your leadership responds to it. The structural issues that I was suggesting, it's almost like an operational cross between what we do with the District of Columbia and our five permanently populated U.S. territories. They kind of have status, but they don't have full status. I couldn't help but notice that there's no veto power being recommended, and recommendations are allowed to be made, but there's no management of money or delivery of services on behalf of the voice. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, it's looking likely to fail at the moment, but as with your election over there, there's miles to walk before we sleep. TJ, a pleasure to talk to you as always. I know you'll stay in touch with Sophie as well.
Always good to speak with you, and please tell Sophie I said hi.
Good on you, TJ.